ton pipeau.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to our podcast, Taking It Down, which is a pop culture discussion brought to you by the website, The Alabama Take. We cover movies, television, music, books on this podcast and on the website as well. Subscribe to us on your podcast app so that you'll hear us each Tuesday morning. One exciting endeavor that's coming from us, our October 27th show will be our very first book club episode where we'll talk about The Only Good Indians, a new release by Stephen Graham Jones. So get your hands on a copy of that and read along with us for what could be a great horror novel for October. We'll find out. Though we're not sure if the horror genre couldn't use a break with what's happening in 2020. Hopefully this will give us an escape from some of that. But today, it's a special episode kind of as well. We're taking listener questions that we've gathered over a few weeks. And then we're going to get into why Lovecraft Country is on the precipice of crashing for us. So I got two other folks on here to help make this show work. First of all, I'm going to go with Donovan first today because I got something special to say about Adam. Donovan, how you doing?
Oh, God.
I'm perfectly fine. But Blake, you mentioned the horror genre could use a break with what's happening in 2020. What's happening in 2020? Is it still coming up? Because we're in September. What's happening?
November 3rd.
What's that?
I'll say no more on the issue. Instead, I'll bring in Adam Morrow, our other co-host. Adam, the reason I got something special to introduce him with this week, he is just fresh from a Velcro Pygmies concert.
Oh, there it is. That's why you wanted to do that.
Tell us your experience from the Velcro. I can't even say their fucking name, and that's a good thing because I don't like them.
I have never had an opinion on them other than seeing their name in front of like the Jupiter in 2009. I didn't know they still existed.
like every week.
Yeah.
They were doing what like Elton John does in Vegas. They were just having like
a
seven-night stand at the Jupiter.
Oh, God. talk about depressing sentences.
That's about seven-night stand at the Jupiter.
That's like a Barry Hanna short story in one sentence.
There's your horror novel, yeah. Guys.
For sale. Jupiter. Jupiter tickets, never used.
Just to clear up anything, if anyone's confused, the Velcro Pygmies posted on their Facebook site just a bunch of pictures of masses of what looked to be relatively 21 or under people, ladies.
21
mainly,
adjacent.
21 adjacent. And that none were wearing masks and none were practicing social distancing. And some are probably dead now.
Well, what do you do when you go see music? Like, if I want to sneeze in someone's mouth when I watch Arcade Fire, this is going to be like I was able to do it then. Why can't I do it now?
As per tradition.
And here we are on our soapbox, but I'm also going to give Adam a little moment to do some promotion. Adam, you and your band Del Rey, or Natalie, your wife.
Me and my wife. Yeah.
You and your wife are playing a show this Saturday.
Oh, we are. This is the first time I have played since February, which is very odd to say.
At least live in front of people and not on a computer.
Yeah, we only did that a few times. I don't know. Mm-hmm. That was a strange experience. But yeah, it's going to be an outdoor show in the Shoals over at Do Right Man Barbershop. Should be a good time. So if you're around the Northwest Alabama area and you got an itch for live music, we'll be over there next Saturday night. It's free. Social distanced, masked. Mm-hmm. Should be good.
So Sunday morning, the pictures won't look like the Velcro Pygmies Facebook page, right?
I've been trying to figure out, like, because people will have beer out there. Is it going to be like the new, like, I'm going to go have a cigarette is I'm going to go have this beer and like you go stand in the corner and drink your beer and then come back to the group? How's this going to work?
I'm picturing a lot of lawn chairs and things like that and people kind of spaced out. Am I picturing something wrong?
I think that'll probably be it. But yeah. I don't anticipate like a very large crowd to deal with. not to sell a short here, but yeah, it should be very manageable. And we're getting some fine fall weather here in North Alabama. So
yeah.
I'm looking forward to it.
And the other bands?
The Neds are going to play. They're a great Florence band. And then our friends Kevin and Sarah Robinson, Kevin Lee Robinson of the former Sheffield mayoral candidate. He's going to play. They have a band, just the two of them, called the Linda McCartneys, which is just a great band name.
So here we are, COVID week 107.
We got to talk about football just briefly.
Okay, bring it up. Yeah,
hell yeah.
It came back yesterday. Like we have danced around this topic. Donovan watches a lot of sports now, which is odd. I can only assume that he's developed like a gambling problem. That has to be why he's watching just the absolute shit shows of college football that have been going the last few weeks. But now, you know, real football is back.
I like to fall asleep to a Syracuse game.
Who doesn't? Any time of the day.
Now, you said real football. Define what you mean, because people, I guess all of our listeners would know, but let's just be clear.
Oh, they know.
SEC football.
Good football.
SEC football.
Good football. It's back. Yeah, and I got to say that I was impressed by all of the stadiums in the SEC seem to be doing a pretty good job on the social distancing.
I saw more frat kids at Ole Miss wearing masks than I did in an entire crowd of Oklahoma fans. So, Ole Miss, y'all are in it to win it. You're going to survive. Maybe not so much the state of Oklahoma.
The message has been conveyed. Well, not after that shit show yesterday, blowing that lead. Maybe the message has been successfully conveyed that football can only continue if you follow these rules. But it was fun to have it back. I found myself like kind of getting into the fact that Auburn wasn't looking that good, and then getting very into Mississippi State beating LSU, and then was just like pretty primed. I was pretty primed for Bama to come on.
K-State upset of Oklahoma, which was awesome. K-State played great. Don't skip. They're gonna wipe you out.
Sure.
Unless they schedule a giant. Whatever Mike Leach is schlubbing around on the sidelines seems to be working at Mississippi State. You know, I really thought he wasn't going to get to coach a game because he was going to get fired. So it's nice to see that he has at least one under his belt. And then, yeah, we got to watch a nice scrimmage for Bama.
It really did look like a scrimmage. Bama looked on top of their game, which was promising.
They look great.
Waddle looked great.
Yeah. I had my doubts about the defense last year, but, you know, that was injury probably related. Yeah. I think the Bama team might be good this year. Well, Adam, you are happy. How much are you back in football mode? Is it there yet? Is COVID still bringing you down some?
I mean, it doesn't feel the same, but it's also very fun to watch Alabama play still. We talked about with Last Chance U, kind of that being like the gear up for football. Like none of that has felt the same, but that's okay. Once they were on my TV, it was enjoyable to watch, and the bloodlust was back immediately. I was in it.
I'm going to interject, I think, an opposing opinion, and I'm going to say that I do not like Mississippi State beating LSU.
But you hate Mississippi State.
Hate them, and I don't like, because that inputs the idea into Mississippi State fans that Mike Leach is going to do amazing, and that kind of worries me because he could do well, and I just don't want that happening. I want LSU to win every game except for maybe Bama and one or two others. Yeah, and I want Bama to be the one that kills their dreams in November. That's the way it's got to be, in my opinion.
It's pretty fun to see them lose their first game after winning a national championship, though.
Yeah, that was
first team since 98 to do that.
Because they lost, what, like 19 starters, something like that? Plus, everybody else has COVID. So we'll see if it was a flash in the pan or if Coach O can actually sustain and grow a program there.
No, he can't.
I don't think he can,
but I do like him.
He's got some great 10-2 seasons coming, I think, but nothing sustainable.
Is it? Do you think that LSU was going to turn into the Michigan of the SEC?
Weren't they already?
Well, Michigan hasn't won a national championship or beaten Ohio State in a while, so
yeah, that's fair.
But do you think they're headed for that?
I kind of that's how I've always pictured them anyway, so I thoroughly agree.
Does that mean that Mississippi State's the Michigan State of the SEC?
What that means is Mississippi State can go to hell.
Don't you think you grew up
too close to Mississippi?
Yeah.
Yeah, for those who don't know, I grew up about maybe 12 miles from Mississippi, maybe less. I can't quite remember, but it was close enough to where there were plenty of Mississippi State flags out in everyone's yard, and just as many Alabama or Auburn flags as there were. So
I personally like Ole Miss a lot more than Mississippi State. Maybe it's just because I think their mascot's cute. Ole Miss doesn't have a cute mascot, anything. I guess Lane Kiffin's kind of a mascot.
Yeah, he totally is. let's shift gears, guys. You two both have thoughts on the new Fleet Foxes album. It's called Shore. I think me being removed from their first album when it came out, I was not their audience, I guess, or I just didn't listen to it. So I think that keeps me from commenting on this one, other beyond saying I found it very pleasant, but you guys were very much raving about it. So,
what do you mean you were removed because you didn't listen to the first record? I'm interested in that.
I was aware of them and I heard a few songs and I thought, basically the same thing I think about this album. I thought, well, that's nice. But I just didn't have an opinion beyond thinking, that's okay. And I probably wouldn't change the channel on a fall day. I might on a summer day or a winter day, but I wouldn't on a fall day. It felt okay, but it just didn't grab me, but I didn't hate it or by any stretch. And to me, Shore felt like a continuation of that in a way, although maybe a little better. I felt it's a great album, but I think me not being a fan initially is what keeps me at arm's length from
that's,
it. But you guys love
that's
it.
Super interesting you say that you feel like it's a continuation. Not that I don't feel like this album just came out of left field, but I think I texted y'all that, like, if you had told me Fleet Foxes was going to put out, like, ever more Baroque pop, like folk pop, like, that would have not surprised me at all. And I think this is maybe even almost more accessible than their first album. It's easy to listen to, but I don't mean that in the way that, like confusing, easy to listen to with lack of quality.
Yeah, to me, this is easily the most mature work that they've done, or that I guess it's really a solo effort.
Yeah.
Because it was made during quarantine times by Robin Pecknold. But, you know, that first record was... This just feels so much more developed, and I feel like he's a guy who, when I think of that first record, I think also of like the first Vampire Weekend record and a few other kind of indie blog darlings of the time that happened to go on and have long careers. And they kind of were some of the last, it was one of the last generations to sneak through into a sustainable career via that method. So I'm always interested in what they're doing. Like, obviously, Vampire Weekend, they are huge and collaborate with giant pop stars, and he's married to a movie star and all this kind of stuff. And Robin Pecknold seemed to deal with fame in a totally different way. Like, he made that second record and, you know, just disappeared for a while and ended up making the third. And now this one just came out of nowhere. And I got to admit, I was a huge fan of the first one. Dug the second one. The third one was cool, but I wasn't like, you know, when it was announced that this was coming out this week, kind of last minute, I wasn't super excited. And then it happened to be like a perfect fall blue sky morning, and I pulled it up to listen, and I was pretty stunned by how good it is.
It's interesting. We'll actually come back to this maybe a little, because what we're going to do is we're going to get into some listener questions. This is first time we've ever done this. We appreciate people giving us some questions to answer, and there's actually one a little later on Fleet Foxes, which, so a little bit of a circle back around. I hate that term. I hate that phrase. Never mind.
Let's circle back on that. Got it.
Yeah, let's circle back on that. That sounds so business. Okay, let's start. I'm just going to, let's just dive in. First of all, head writer for the Alabama Take, T.D. Wood. A lot of these folks are associated with the Alabama Take. So if you want your question asked for the next time we do this, get it in. We'll be happy to answer anyone's. But TD is one of the originators of the Alabama Take website, and he asked a couple questions. First of all, he says, Marvel moved Black Widow to 2021, making this the first year without a new MCU movie since 2009. So how angry does this make the Disney gods, and is everyone ready for the barrage of releases to come over the next 2 years? Donovan, what do you think?
Does Disney have gods?
I mean, Disney has removed the need for God, I think.
That's it right there. So, Donovan, are you big on the MCU?
You know, I think I've seen all of them. I like them. You know, it's something fun to do.
Yeah, me too.
But I also kind of find myself like exhausted by them. Like, I've read a couple articles recently, right, about how like promising young filmmakers go through like the Marvel machine, and like they make good movies. They're still very, very much Marvel movies. Like, it's very, it's almost like back in the studio system where, right, like the producer more than the giraffe scene is like, the animating force behind them. So they kind of suck up all the oxygen. I'm excited. Like, they've been a lot of fun, but I just like, I'm starting to feel exhausted by them in equal measure now that I've had a break from them.
Well, you've gotten a good break in 2020. So, you know, does that reinvigorate or does that cause you to be removed from it to where you've lost interest now?
I think I'm a little removed from it, so I have a little less interest. But I also suspect that this is going to be like football. You know, like when I can go back to a movie theater and see Black Widow, I'm going to be there.
Yeah, me too. I feel the same way. But you know what has me a little bit more interested than Black Widow? The television shows that are supposed to be on Disney Plus.
I'm hoping, you know, I'm kind of intrigued too, just because I'm hoping that like the stakes aren't as high, so it'll be a little weirder. But also, mm-hmm. I don't think they're going to drop anything too mind-blowing Disney Plus, but we'll see. It could be fun.
Well, you know, Disney Plus seems willing to do big budget stuff on their television show. If using the only example, The Mandalorian,
sure,
it looked well done.
I'm hoping we get something suitably weird with WandaVision.
It seems as though we might,
especially because did you watch Legion? Noah Hawley did it. So it's a superhero show, right? It takes place in the X-Men universe, but it just feels really weird. And there's a lot of, you know, kind of like Fargo, just throw stuff to the wall and see what sticks. And that is the kind of thing, like, I was excited. Even when it was like in the second season, it was kind of like, well, you know, I don't know if this makes a whole lot of sense, but it sure is pretty. Like, I was excited to watch it because it felt new, right? And so my hope would be I get something I'm excited to watch because it's weird and strange and they're kind of willing to take a risk.
I did watch the first season of Legion and was not, it frustrated me a lot.
I think that's fair. I loved it, but I can see why I can see why people would be frustrated by it. I thought it was fantastic.
All right, so TD also asked one of my favorite questions that we got, although we got some good ones. Who would you pick to save Westworld and why is it David Lynch?
I mean, the answer is in the question, right?
There it is.
There's only one option.
Wow, who would I pick to save Westworld? Someone who can save it. Who can save it? David Lynch. Next question.
So Westworld wants to be this I can beat Reddit type of show. I can outsmart the internet kind of show. And what they needed to probably do is, what David Lynch could bring to the table is to be weird and odd and ambiguous and not worry about solving its issues and just throwing it out there and say, fuck it.
It does seem like Westworld came about at a time where like True Detective had just kind of fumbled the second season, but like there were a lot of shows where figuring it out was a big part of it, like predicting Breaking Bad or trying to predict how Mad Men was going to end or all these things. And it reeked of what you said, like this is made for a bullet point Reddit post.
A mystery show of some sort, I guess.
I was just about to say, I feel like Westworld is like composed of 90% significant glances.
What? Explain that.
Well, you know what I mean? Where it's like, oh, there's some mystery, but like, there's really like, there's no substance to anything, right? It's just like, oh, well, we'll kind of talk around what we're, instead of just saying what we mean, we're going to have characters that just talk around it for 12 episodes. Not because it's crucial. Not because it's integral to them as characters, but because we're just trying to tease it out longer. I stopped watching in the second season, if you can't tell.
Oh, okay. Well, I did watch this third season, and the first two or three episodes had promise, and then they went back to their old shenanigans,
It just feels like all style, no substance.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Next question from Zachary Stewart, also has written for the Alabama Take. So do you think that Tyler Childers' new album, Long Violent History, was effective at reaching out to rural country music audiences concerning the message of the song, which was anti-racism and those sentiments? And are you guys familiar with his?
I am not.
Yeah.
I know that he posted that A Message from Tyler video. Yeah. And that definitely made the rounds and got the usual, some people saying it's so great you're doing this and other people saying you should have stuck to music, that kind of thing. I don't know. It's very interesting. It seems like there's more and more artists in, you know, I think about somebody like Jason Isbell, who's never really hidden what he's all about, but is now, there's a lot of folks like him who are more blatant. Whereas even in like 2015, 16, maybe they would have just hinted at things, which I don't know, kudos to him. Kudos to all of these folks for challenging their livelihood, really. I mean, they could alienate enough people to watch a career go down the tubes. But I mean, I do think that still there are more good guys than bad guys in this situation. I don't know. As far as the effectiveness, you would probably know better than me, Blaine.
But yeah, I don't know. I did watch the video. It was about a 5-6 minute video. Well constructed. You could tell he had written out what he wanted to say about the album. And he does mention in the first few sentences that he was going to release the album without any context, but he decided to produce the video. It was good. The message of his video was good. I really haven't listened to much of that album, maybe a song or two. Or maybe it is just a song, and I listened to that one, but I don't know. I really don't know. Here's my opinion. I think those people who don't want to hear that message aren't going to hear that message, you know, no matter where they are or who they are. If they're fans of Tyler Childers, they're going to ignore that and listen to the music. And if they're fans of, like, the Truckers who have been doing this for years, they're going to say, fuck your thoughts, but I do like your songs.
It astounds me still that, you look at a Patterson Hood post, even this week, and there's still people mad at him for expressing an opinion. It's like, what band have you been listening to for the last 20 years?
I've got one even better than that. It's, I wish I remember the year, but I was at a Bruce Springsteen concert, and the guy directly in front of me yells to Springsteen. You know, Springsteen give a little bit of a rant, not a rant, a little bit of a, you know, here's the story behind the song, very short, political, and the guy yells, I hate your politics, but I love you, Bruce. And I'm just like, oh, who, you know, Bruce has been around for a while.
Well, when we went to see, you know, you two did the Joshua Tree tour celebration, and it just so worked out that the only one that we could go see was in Pittsburgh.
Right, I remember that.
Because of, like, weird, I was on tour the rest of the summer, and so we went to see it, and it was a good show. But people in the crowd, as we were leaving, it was at Heinz Field. We were leaving through the bowels of Heinz Field, and people were upset. They were like, oh, I wish they would have kept the politics out of that. It's like, what band have you, you know, I mean, these people, if they were in the stands near the front, that is a lot of money to plunk down on a band that you don't, how do you not know at this point? How are you surprised that Bono has opinions?
I mean, their very first album, Jesus.
Yeah, I don't, it's an odd phenomenon.
Right, and with, I'm with critic Matt Zoller-Seitz. He's my favorite TV critic. He says,
oh, I like him too.
Boy, yeah, he's so good. And his Twitter is really, really good. I agree with about 98% of what he posts. But he said once, and I think I've quoted him here before on this exact same quote, is art is politics and vice versa. He kind of said that.
It is. You can't have any art without it. And I've wondered before, the three of us are obviously engaging with music on like a, when I say deeper, I don't mean like we understand it more, but like
no,
on a dorkier
don't.
Level. Like, it seems to to be a bigger part of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
So it's odd that I've tried to think, like, maybe people just want to listen to something nice on the radio, because I can't imagine not understanding that, you know, like, you love artists because a good songwriter has empathy. So, like, maybe their opinion on something like the pandemic or, like, the presidential election, maybe you should, if you want to listen to their songs. The reason you like it is because they can understand other people.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you should at least let them express that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. The idea of things, even like sports being apolitical, pisses me off when I think about how many Bama games I've been to where there was a flyover or like a salute to the military or like all these things. Like all of these things are political.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah. No, it's only, it seems like we've learned that keep politics out of sports only applies to black folks.
Yeah.
Different rules for white people.
If you want to promote some nationalism, go right ahead.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, to not go off on a tangent, but I
Please
think
do.
I think the scary thing about what Adam just picked up is that I think for a lot of folks they would be like, there's nothing political about a military flyover. That's honoring the troops, like that. There's not a recognition that it's political.
Right,
and
that's frustrating.
That's kind of frightening.
Well, it's frustrating, too, because if you point that out, the act of caring enough to point it out, to me, is patriotic.
Absolutely.
and discounting people's patriotism when they don't agree with your nationalism is why we're in the situation that we're in.
Absolutely. But it's, anyway. It is kind of right. Like, what's the right, like, I think something we at least try and think about or talk about on this show, right, is what's the, okay, right, everything is political. So what are the, what are the invisible frames, right? What are the things that we don't think is, right? What do we think is just normal and natural? And can we recognize that? And can we talk about it? And can we go somewhere with that? I mean, it's hard, right? It's like the stupid joke about the fish, right? Water's great today. You know, other fish looks at the other fish, goes, what the hell is water, right? Like, it's tough to do, but I do think it's important.
Yeah.
So Zach also had another question. He said, thoughts on Netflix's The Social Dilemma. He comments that he's yet to see it, but really wanted to. I'm in the same boat. I haven't seen it, and I have seen 3 or 4 people post about it and even go so far as to say because of this documentary, they're going to stay off Facebook for a week or two or whatever, or maybe they didn't put a timeline on it. I did see the guy who seems to be one of the central figures of the documentary on a 60 Minutes segment, and he probably said about the same thing he's going to say in the documentary, that social media is designed for you to keep returning and to give you that dopamine fix. It's probably just more of that, but I am always open to a good documentary. You guys have you seen this? Have you seen people talking about it?
I mean, I think Netflix should be illegal, but because they facilitated genocide in Myanmar, not by their own admission, not necessarily because of the dopamine rush. There's been a lot of deleterious effects to Netflix being introduced to countries around the world, possibly including our own.
Are you Netflix or Facebook?
Netflix or Facebook.
Did I say Netflix? I meant
you
Facebook.
Said it twice.
I'm sorry, guys.
Keep Netflix out of this.
Yeah, for Christ's sake, we love our Netflix.
Clearly, my subconscious hates Netflix too. Now, nah, Facebook got to be illegal.
Well, I think I don't know.
I've thought about that a lot. Like, do we think that social media is a net gain or a net loss at this point in society? I'm strongly on team loss.
So I was at a when I was the departmental liaison for the Department of Communication at the University of Connecticut. I went to a speaker that they had, and one of the points that he made about social media as we currently have it is that people expect a public good in, you know, capital letters from a private company. And those two, the way we have it set up right now, those two things are incompatible.
Big C capitalism.
That's all it is.
Yeah. I mean, it's just precisely, I mean, it's not a public good. It is a public company. It is, if Mark Zuckerberg can facilitate authoritarianism around the world and make money doing it, like the system is set up to reward that, right? Like from a like pull, if you take almost like a totally amoral glance at it, right? Like he's not even doing anything quote unquote wrong or illegal. Mm-hmm. And that's the issue.
Yeah. It makes dumb people feel smart. Yeah. That's my thing.
I was going to say, like, the danger is that it creates, everyone can create this little reality to live in that can just get further and further from the actual capital T truth. And that's, I don't know. When I think about, like, it's not even like a party thing, but if I think about, say that the good guys win in November, according to us.
Mm-hmm.
And democracy is able to survive. Like, how do you put the pieces back together when 20% of the population just outright refuses to believe fact? I don't know.
I would put that percentage higher.
We'll see.
Well, let's move on before we get too depressed. Trey Irby asks, our guy Trey Irby and writer for the Alabama Take. He covers a lot of gaming things and various other stuff. We like old Trey. He asks, what do y'all think Billy Idol is up to? And can Donovan do a reading of his classic Eyes Without a Face?
Trey, how the fuck would I know what Billy Idol's up to?
He doesn't live in Connecticut?
Not the last time I checked.
Check again.
I will say Eyes Without a Face is my favorite Billy Idol song.
Mine too. That song's a jam.
My buddy Raz. I think we all are friends with Raz. He actually was a guest once on the podcast. So,
dear Raz.
Yeah, he asked some good questions. What will the effect of the pandemic be on pop culture? He notes that it's already had a huge impact on movies, which we don't have to get into. But given that people have had the opportunity to work at home for longer, do you think there'll be an increase in creative or new projects or an overall decline? How many shows or books will exist? Were the circumstances of the pandemic, you know, is that going to work its way into the production of those kinds of things? And Adam, I'm going to give this one to you first because you are an artist. You do make music and write songs. So tell us what you think.
I think on the surface level, well, not on the surface level, the behind the scenes level, the practical level, I guess I should say, with music, and I guess with everything, there's going to be a really clear line of the haves and the have-nots. And in music, that line is maybe sharper than people realize, the threshold for it, people who are really struggling right now. Like we talked about the Fleet Foxes record, and I think we're going to return to that, so I'll just use it as an example. That band cannot tour for 2 years and be fine, right? They can continue to spend money to make a record and know that when they put it out, they're going to make money on the record. For people who have to tour and making a record is a speculative endeavor at best financially, I think there's going to be a lot of people lost. Like people who were making records and making music at the beginning of 2020 who will never do it again full time. Mm-hmm. It's really sad. I mean, that's capitalism, I guess. I don't know. In terms of how it affects art, again, to return to the Fleet Foxes, because to me and Donovan talked about this in text, I think that's the first album that I'm going to continue listening to past this year, from this year. Like, the first, like, pandemic piece that I've really enjoyed. Like, it seems to address 2020, to do so with its eyes open, but still kind of aware that it's being introduced into kind of dire circumstances, and do it well to me. So I think I'm going to continue to enjoy that. It'll be interesting to see. I think music is going to be a little happier. Like the Fleet Foxes record to me sounds like an easy listening kind of fall morning thing. I think maybe the end of Sad Guy with Acoustic Guitar is going to happen for a little while. In terms of,
Wait, I'm going to stop you right there. Why do you think that's going to end?
I think people are kind of, you know, even we joked about the Velcro Pygmies having their show. Like people, even if you're, right, not to bring them into the artistic conversation, but people, I think, have this desire to go feel some community, to feel some uplift. And, you know, people, songwriters joke about you write sad songs when the sun is shining and you write happy songs when it's shitty. And I think people want some catharsis and they don't necessarily want to wallow in feeling bad. I think it could be a bit of a shift. And, you know, I think one of the reasons that I'm so impressed by records like that Fleet Foxes record is it's hard to write happy stuff that is compelling artistically.
It's very, I was just about to comment that I always found it easier to write a sad song than a happier song.
So I don't know. That's a lot of thinking aloud from me, but I know that the economic side of things have been very rough on people. A lot of people kind of looking around going, well, what do I do now? But, you know, people have had time to write that book that they maybe wouldn't have otherwise, or really dwell on a screenplay or something. So I don't know. Donovan, I'm sure, could weigh in through the history of literature about moments when humanity had to pause and what came out of that.
I was going to actually kind of agree with Adam. What Adam said was my thought about what's this going to mean for pop culture is the pandemic seems to have already exacerbated existing trends in America. And one of the trends that's doing that is that the rich get richer, poor get poorer. And I think we're going to see that. And I do kind of wonder, you know, to kind of speak to Adam's point, like, you know, some folks have more time and maybe that's going to be great, right? Like maybe someone's writing their book. But I also kind of think of the argument of Virginia Woolf in A Room of One's Own, right? Like Shakespeare's imaginary sister didn't have a room to just write. She was taking care of people. And, you know, if you're taking care of your kids or your whatever, or you don't have a job, or I just wonder if there's not a lot of, you know, economic and material impact, because so many times, right, when when everybody has to pause and plague, or, you know, everyone's getting out of town or whatever. Like, a lot of the times, the people doing creating art, they had, like, someone doing their laundry. You know, they had someone cooking their meals for them, right? Like, they weren't watching their own kids, you know, that kind of thing. So it'll be interesting. I don't know. It'll be interesting.
The history of art is not free from the same privilege that the rest of history is.
Absolutely, right? It's like, or, you know, one of the things in academia, right, is there's this incredible emphasis on publishing, right? Like, you're going to teach all these classes and you're going to publish. Well, a lot of these rules came in when, you know, you can see this pretty easily if you know the right search. Just look through dissertations and manuscripts for mentions of my wife. Like, a ton of people, professors were getting their wives for their typing things for them and editing it, right? Like, there's this invisible assumption that like you're the person doing it all, but you're not really doing it, right? Like, there's all this invisible labor that goes into, like, I wrote a book. Mm-hmm. You know, Hemingway wasn't cooking his own meals, right? He was going to the cafe. He had time to write.
Little did people know, well, maybe they did, that taking it down meant taking down capitalism. So that's what we're all about. Reyes did have another question. Who did kill Laura Palmer?
Oh, David Lynch did.
We all did. Yeah.
We all killed Laura Palmer.
I think it was the evil of the world that killed her.
The evil men do.
Jeff, our buddy Jeff, the Jeff, photographer Jeff.
Hefe.
He asked, pop culture question. And he writes, maybe too obscure. Except for Community, is there ever a good reason, or have there ever been a good reason to have a flashback episode of television?
Well, we got that fun song at the end of that one's Simpsons clip show, so that's, you know.
God, the Simpsons clip show song is going to be in my head the rest of the afternoon now.
It's great.
I think there are a lot of good reasons to have flashback episodes. I don't think that's a hit or a miss just because it is a flashback episode. I think it goes into why you're having it and the writing in general.
I think Jeff means clip show episodes.
Is that what he means?
I think so, because that when he references Community, they do an episode where it's a clip show episode, but it's all things you haven't seen before. So it's doing the clip show trope. That's what I'm guessing, because he said Community.
Oh, like in sitcoms in the 80s.
Yeah, exactly. Even Scrubs. Oh. Scrubs did one, right?
So I'm going to say no then. Yeah. No.
Yeah, those suck.
There's not a good episode. Yeah, they do suck. They're filler. They're what you would make in, like, say, a pandemic when you couldn't get everybody together. You'd go find clips and put them together, right? Am I wrong?
It is an insane idea now in, like, the era of prestige television to, like, consider a writer's room saying, like, oh, clip show this week, so everybody, you know, what are they doing? They're just taking the week off?
We were on strike!
Well, there's that, too. Right.
I mean, some of it has to do, right, with, like, the productions. Like you said, Adam, prestige television, right? Because you're not producing as many episodes. So some of it's got to be production schedule, and some of it's got to be, like, we're trying to hit, what is it, 100 for syndication?
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's
where the real money is, if we can make it to syndication.
Okay, so he meant clip show.
I think so.
If he meant flashback, I would say that has been a fairly important part of some of my favorite shows, like off-the-cuff Mad Men.
I was just going to say.
You know, it's been done well before. So if we're not misinterpreting you there, I will submit Mad Men as an important example of the necessity of flashback.
Even, gosh, one of the best ones I can think of. I think you hit it on the head. Hell, Breaking Bad did a whole season as a flashback.
All right, so here's what we'll do. Let's take a break. We're going to return to some listener questions. We have a few more to answer. And then we're going to talk a little bit of Lovecraft before we wrap. Hey, folks, we spare you any ads in this podcast unless you count our own Buy Me a Coffee account. Think Patreon, but with more whimsy. If you'd like to help the site and podcast continue, visit buymeacoffee.com/thealabamatake, and you can make a donation of any amount. And we would love it if you could do that. Also, don't forget, grab the new Stephen Graham Washington horror novel, The Only Good Indians, and let's discuss that on October 27th episode. Lastly, share us online, tell a friend. We have all sorts of episodes on all kinds of topics, pop culture related. Surely there's one for you. But let's get back to our show. Okay, we got more questions. Listener questions. So Hayden Crawford asks pointedly, why do people like Fleet Foxes?
Because we're stupid.
Why is Hayden so obstinate? I don't
That's
know.
That's it? Is that
how do you, I mean, I don't know how to, you know, again, we're really hammering the Fleet Foxes this episode, but there is that generation of bands that continue to stick around. Like, think about the Vampire Weekends and Fleet Foxes of the world that, you know, or the Bon Ivers or all these things that became so hateable to so many people that now, even if they make great stuff, I feel like people can't get over themselves to listen to it.
That sounds fair to me. Natalie Morrow, I'm not sure if we know this person. She asks, if you could take an element, character, theme, universe, rule, etc., from one show or movie you watched this year and add it to another show or movie, what would it be?
I can tell you where this came from. We watched that show, The Eco Challenge, that's on Amazon Prime. And these people race for, like, basically, if you have 11 days to complete this course and, like, they don't sleep at night and they're mountain biking through the jungle and climbing and doing all this crazy stuff. And I joked and said, what if at the end they pull up on this beach after paddling their canoes for miles across the Pacific Ocean and there's a hall brawl and CT standing there? So that's where this came from. So, I mean, obviously that's my choice, but she had some good ideas. I don't know. What do you got? I immediately think about devs. Like, if you could mix devs into some world, or maybe drop in, like, what would Perry Mason do in the Watchmen universe? I don't know.
Donovan, what you got?
This is how nerds are born.
Yeah,
asking these kinds of questions. This is a really good question, and I'm kind of mulling it over. I'm not sure I have an answer for it right off the top of my head. It's such an interesting question. I feel like we were edging at this last week when we all suggested David Lynch could direct a Star Wars movie.
Or David Lynch take over Westworld.
Or David Lynch take over Westworld.
We have one solution to the problem of the world.
Just let David Lynch direct it.
Yeah.
What else is he doing?
Is it too late to vote third party David Lynch? No, I think that would be my answer, is to get someone who's quirky and interesting to do something with, and give them free reign to do something with Star Wars or MCU, or, you know, some of this franchise stuff that's starting to become a little factory.
Especially Ray, because, you know, it's like the movies are more like an assembly line for remember this character, then I have a, you know, the chicken comes before the egg, right? Like, we're going to make a movie about these characters. And now you need to come up with a story, instead of I have this story I just have to tell, and these are the characters to tell it.
I will probably think of a very good answer to this question after the podcast. That's usually what happens.
This is a shower question, right? Like, you come up with a good answer in the shower.
Kelly Duncan, friend of the pod, also guest on the pod.
Friend of the pod.
She's got several questions, all of which are good. Who is the best TV or movie cat? Cannot be Toonsis. Sorry, Toonsis.
Who is Toonsis?
What?
Who's Toonsis?
Saturday Night Live. You should jot down a note.
I don't know this.
Okay, we'll Google it later.
Okay.
Yeah, you'll love it. Saturday Night Live skit. Reoccurring Saturday Night Live skit. So who's the best TV cat?
My head. I mean,
this is a Donovan question if I've ever heard.
I can't think of any other than the Salem from Sabrina the Teenage Witch.
Is that your... Okay.
No, that's not
stick with that for an answer.
I'm very fond of the cat in the cat bus in My Neighbor Totoro, so maybe I'll say that that's the best cat. Cats are kind of hard to work with, though. You know, they don't get in...
I know, I imagine. I always get really nervous when I see an animal on screen, because I think to myself, okay, how much abuse did they have to endure to get them to do whatever?
I actually read this great article about, you know, they remade Pet Sematary, 2 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
And about the cat that was acting in it, and the trainers, and how they get the cat to do it. And basically, it's just like they just blast the cat with catnip until it's comfortable. Like, if they want it to do a scene and stuff, it's like, okay, well, we're going to put the catnip out. So, like, the cat has to be comfortable first, or it can't act. So it takes a super long time, but it's also really fascinating to see, like, what they do. And they have to kind of, like, learn their cat's personalities, right? Because one of them, you know, because, right, the cat gets killed by a truck. or something.
Then you're down a cat.
So you have to, in the movie, I mean, so that one of theirs was pretty comfortable with, they had multiple cats doing the one role. And one of them was like more comfortable with wearing the makeup, which is all like, it's like egg and stuff like that. So there's no chemicals to not hurt it. It was really, really interesting to read about what went into these, how you get a cat to act in a movie. Cause it does not seem easy. That's why we only got one episode with Sir Pounce, who is also a good movie cat.
Mm. There's my answer.
Sir Pounce. That's pretty good.
So her second question, what's the most iconic Beyonce moment?
Ooh,
Super Bowl,
Adam. This feels up your alley.
I can think of several. The top two that I immediately think of, and I have a winner, but the top two, her baby bump reveal at the VMAs or whatever bullshit awards it was. That was very good. Jeez, her opening the Grammys was really good. She's got a lot of choices when you know she is unafraid to swing the bat when it comes to her big cultural. Pop culture opportunities, but I think her Coachella performance is probably the best thing that she's done, and then making it available the way that she did, and that was pretty stunning.
I would say her Super Bowl moment where, and I feel so sorry for Coldplay because they weren't they the headliner, so to speak?
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. That was pretty great. This is amazing that she has so many of these moments that there are ones you forget about, and you're like, oh, holy shit, that was great. But she stole the show.
Totally. That's what you remember. You don't even remember Coldplay performed, honestly. It's kind of sad for them, but great for her. And she owned it.
I have a pretty funny, someone who shall not be named, I suppose, was at the Grammys when she performed. This person that I know, I only know several people who have been to the Grammys, so this shouldn't be too hard to figure out. They took their son, and Beyonce was like on stage right in front of them doing her thing, and he realized that his 12 or 13-year-old son is like, this is probably like a big moment when you watch Beyonce dance like that, just feet away from you. You know, that probably sticks with you, and he just kind of lamented for his son, well, this is, you have reached the zenith, the mountaintop.
Seeing Beyonce in person, that's got to be breathtaking.
Got to be something.
Another question. She's got a few, and they're all good, so I want to get to them. So who was more influential or impactful in Black female literature, Toni Morrison or Zora Neale Hurston, and why?
Or
others?
I am too dumb to answer this question. And also, I don't want to get canceled by giving a bad answer.
Do you have a preference?
I'm just going to go with Toni Morrison simply because Zora Neale Hurston had a sort of limited output. And that, but though, you know, quantity doesn't mean quality, but I still think that Toni Morrison just had a bit, that she had more influence because of quantity, I think. That's my answer.
I'd like to put in a plug for Octavia Butler here, too. I've seen a lot of folks discussing her. The Parable of the Sower books that she did. She's a fantastic author with some stories that'll really leave you awake at night. And she died way too soon. And she's kind of an obvious go-to answer, especially if you're talking about black people and black women writing in science fiction. The not very funny joke that Sam Delaney references is there are only two black writers in science fiction, Sam Delaney and Octavia Butler. And they'd sit them together at their tables together and things and have them be, they're doing different things, but they could only be in dialogue with each other, right? Because they were both black. So it is a little over obvious answer, but I think Octavia Butler has been influential to
that's good.
Almost a different part of the populace than it different in the same that the folks that read Zora, Neale Hurston and Toni Morrison.
She, Kelly asks, how do you all choose the books, movies, songs you will review? Will there ever be a time when Blaine's wife can recommend one and he not respond with, no, I'm not doing it?
Join the club, Kelly, am I right?
Yeah, I mean, how do you think we feel?
Hey, we often take your suggestions.
We do, it's a productive group text.
Yeah.
I'll say that my process is usually I try to pick something either new or somewhat trending, like The Social Dilemma would have been a good example. So I saw about 3 or 4 people talking about it online, and I might say, I'm also interested in that, so I'll watch it, and maybe the guys will want to talk about it. The other thing is just stuff we're already into, like a new season of, you name the show, whatever new season is out, and we're probably going to watch it anyway. That seems to fit the bill. That's my process normally. What about you guys? If you are thinking about something and you end up texting me or our group chat, what goes into what you think is good for the pod?
It's definitely whatever hits the criteria you just said. And also, what am I probably going to do anyway?
Yeah, I think we all have pretty similar viewing habits. I mean, really, we just watch whatever HBO tells us to watch.
Yeah, I mean, HBO's tired and true. They do tend to put out shows I like more than I dislike. And they also have a good job lately with I May Destroy You, of an example, something that I might not watch on my own, but simply because it was on HBO, it gets my attention.
Yeah.
We're HBO homers, honestly. Let's see. List the top three song duets of any time, any genre.
There are a lot of damn questions on here.
Yeah. She had a pile of them, and I thought they were all good enough. I didn't want to ignore.
Kelly, have these been saved up?
It seemed like it, right? So I'll go ahead and throw one out. I'll say Tom Petty, Stevie Nicks, Stop Dragging My Heart Around. That's my choice.
That's pretty good. I'm having one of those days where I can't think of any duets. The only one that comes into my head is Freddie Mercury and David Bowie, and I don't even really like that song that much.
Under Pressure?
It's pretty iconic, though.
That's my favorite by anything Freddie Mercury did.
That's mine, too, because David Bowie said it. I'm not a huge fan.
Yeah, there you go. Adam, you're our music guy as far as producing and making music. You got a choice here?
I'm not sure that I do. I think that the Stevie Nicks, Tom Petty one is probably would have been my pick.
So you're going to pick the obvious Kenny Rogers, Dolly Parton.
Now I feel like idiots are not picking.
It's pretty great. It's pretty great.
I hate that song. I'm just going to throw that out there.
You know, I think the best duet of all time, now that I've had some time to reflect on it, it's 5 o'clock somewhere. That's the best. Like when Jimmy Buffett goes, or Alan goes, hey, Jimmy. Hey, Alan.
That is pretty great.
And the music video, even better, right? Because they cut to a Margaritaville. Fantastic. It's 5 o'clock somewhere. Best duet of all time.
That's who gets the award then. So what are some, this is a good question and one I often think about. What are notable examples of cases in which the movie is better than the book?
I was talking about this with someone I used to work with at UConn, and he said, really, it's only minor books that make better movies than the book, right? Because if you're trying to adapt something that's too good, it's not going to work. I'll say Blade Runner. Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep is fine, but I don't feel like I need to ever watch it again. I mean, read it again, but I like Blade Runner pretty well. They're pretty loosely related, so that might be a little bit of a cop-out.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like Game of Thrones would have been on this list. not too far in the past, and it is firmly not anymore. Yeah.
Boy.
Probably.
Yeah. What?
We don't know.
Season too long, huh?
I've got a few, and these are... I didn't have to think too hard about this one because I've always had these on the tip of my tongue for this question. Forrest Gump is by far a better movie than the book.
That's a good one. I've never even read the book because I've heard it's pretty crummy. That's
crummy.
What I've heard.
The other one is Fight Club is a much better movie than the book.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
I'll go with The Shining.
That's a good one. That's a good one.
And probably the most controversial one is No Country for Old Men is as good a movie as a book. I'll say that.
I'll go with that.
I'm not going to argue with you.
Television, Normie Peeps was a little bit better TV show than book. Just a little. Little Fires Everywhere.
Sometimes I wonder for TV shows and stuff if you almost get a bump from just like the empathy of being able to see human beings on the screen do it instead of just having to imagine it. I wonder if the actors can kind of bump it up.
They did for that show. And my last example is Little Fires Everywhere was quite a bit better than the book, but that's a television show and not a movie. They used a black lady, Kerry Washington, to fill the role of the housekeeper and the struggling artist. And that really propelled some thematic things that the book didn't have. So I thought that was a good choice by the writers.
I figured you were just going to go with To Kill a Mockingbird. Shows what I know.
No, the book's a little better, but the movie's fantastic in its own. It's kind of like a different animal.
Yeah, that's one of the few that I think are almost on equal footing in a way.
It's a lot like No Country for Old Men. If you watch or read one or the other, you're not going to be disappointed.
I was just about to say that, right? Like, the book is doing book things, and the movie is doing movie things, and they both work, which is the greatest adaptation, yeah, right? Because you're not adapting a book, you're making a movie.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Good point. So what's your stance? Last question from Kelly. What's your stance on the recent female libido anthem, WAP, is it WAP? Do we call it WAP? Controversy, in which some are saying it's too sexual. Is this true, or is it an example of sexism in music? So,
it's sexism in music.
I think two things here.
I think that WAP is the one of the only songs I've ever heard where the clean lyrics are worse than the just the explicit lyrics. So hats off. And I'm the wrong person to ask, because I turned off the music video halfway through because I was bored. It just didn't work for me.
Why?
I don't know. It just was. I was. This is fine. I wanted to see what it was about.
I didn't. Too sexy?
No, I just didn't care. The male counterpoint of this, I'm usually pretty unlikely to care about. So I'm going to say sexism in music.
As your follow-up question, what's the total dollar amount Donovan would have to have on a GoFundMe page to do a WAP TikTok dance and post it?
I'm going to have to check with my accountant on that one. Because it would have to be enough.
Is your accountant Dr. Beth? Dr. Beth Ryan?
Yes. it would have to be enough so that I would never have to work again for when I lose my job the next day after posting that.
Good point.
So yeah. if I can become independently wealthy through doing this, that's the dollar amount.
Good to bring up TikTok. TikTok has been the source of two of my favorite videos lately. We're talking about taking in pop culture. We neglected last week to talk about the viral video of the guy chainsawing the tree down. That's the greatest piece of comedy that I've seen in 2020.
Endless joy.
I bet I watched that 100 times.
I can hear his scream of agony echoing in my head right now.
Yeah. That guy is, I think I told somebody, he's the Van Gogh of cursing. I mean, it was just like masterful. But now the guy, he appears to be on the skateboard singing Fleetwood Mac. Have y'all seen this? He's just like cruising around. It brings me a lot of joy.
No, I'll have to look at that for that one.
Anyway, TikTok got me thinking.
Well, before we wrap, let's talk a couple things here. So I just want to give a shout out. Talking about what do we choose to cover on the show, our show. There is an HBO series currently running on Mondays, a limited series called The Third Day. I feel like I've watched the first episode, but I feel like this one's crackling. I don't know. Maybe it could go off the rails, which is something we're going to talk about in a little bit with Lovecraft Country, but I highly recommend this one just to see if it's as good as it seems like it is. Plenty of close-ups of Jude Law's reactions to batshit crazy things that about this particular setting. So I wouldn't mind talking about it here online, but if anyone's watching that one, reach out to me. I'm itching to say more. So Lovecraft Country, guys. What was?
Yeah,
I'll start. Here's what I was feeling after that episode titled Strange Case, which is, this show's not good. It's not great for sure, but it's maybe not even not good. So just for reference,
I've landed on, you know, we were saying the question every week was, is this show good? And there are good things in it. There are good actors. There are good set designers. There are good, but it doesn't feel compelling. Like, I felt compelled the first episode, real dip in quality the second episode, third, the haunted house one. Okay, we're back on the right track. Now I'm just, it's almost hard. It felt hard for me to really think through and talk about this because I'm like, could it be because I'm just feeling that like my quote unquote story isn't at the center of things? And am I feeling that? But it is really not speaking to me.
Do you mean you're like the fact that you're white?
Yes, I do. you know, and I want to at least, you know, kind of what I was talking about with like invisible lenses or framing earlier, like hope I can at least have that awareness in the back of my head that like, hey, some things just aren't for me, but I don't think in the sense that like, it's not made for you and that's okay. Like learn to extend yourself and learn about other people and don't have it all come to you. I don't think it's that. I think it's just not clicking. There's too little, there's been a couple, I think the last, have you seen the last episode, Blaine?
The most recent one. The most recent one.
So
sure.
I felt like I didn't care yet. It was all flashback and I didn't care.
Right. With the, I tell you what, let's before we reference that episode, there's one thing I think that's certainly happening with this show is that the stakes are gone.
Yeah.
There just aren't any stakes. And just to go even further, that episode called Strange Case, that's the one that's largely about Ruby and her metamorphosis into a white woman, going back to being black several times throughout that runtime. My thoughts are that the show's, of course, entertaining. It's well acted. It's well shot. It's beautiful. It keeps my interest throughout the 50 minutes, but it just doesn't handle themes well. And these are themes that are worth exploring and are need to be talked about and need to be seen on television and movies, but they aren't weaved into Lovecraft Country, the television show.
Yep.
And that's a big issue. It feels like there's a theme sitting on the right over here and there's a television show on the left, and they don't ever come combined. And I don't mean right and left politically. I mean, they're just divided.
It seems like they're building a really big world that you know, the plane is huge right now. Lines everywhere from Korea to whatever's going on throughout America. It's like, but how do you ground all of that? How do you bring it together? Because obviously they're trying to connect all of these things, but my buddy Todd Bean texted me the perfect 5-word summation of this. I hadn't seen the most recent episode yet, and he beat me to it, and he just texted, Lovecraft Country is buck wild. Like, that's pretty much it.
Did he mean that in a good way or a bad way?
I'm not sure. I mean, even if you think it's good, it's definitely buck wild. And if you want to take away from it, you could say that buck wildness is not doing it any favors.
What really?
Have you seen the most recent episode yet, Adam?
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
Okay.
I was a day behind, and he texted that, and I texted him during the episode. It was like, I think I know which scene you were watching when you texted me this.
And the most recent episode that we've watched is the flashback episode to when Tick is in Korea, dealing with this love interest he has with a Korean young lady who is actually a monster of some sort because her mother wanted her daughter to fight the abuse she was getting.
It's wild. Again, your point about like here are these themes that carry so much weight and would be very difficult to work in, and they're just kind of leaving them to the side. They're not really connecting with the plot in a big way. And there's even moments in this that, you know, you've seen how he gets treated when he goes back home, and he's aware when he's in Korea that he's fighting for a country that will treat him that way. But then there's all of the, again, the buck wildness that happens with whatever the monster is there.
Donovan, you have mentioned to me an article you read about the movie Antebellum. It's receiving quite similar or adjacent complaints that, and you said you're grated by how the show seems to want us as viewers to pat ourselves on the back for having watched it.
Yeah. So
what did you mean?
So my thoughts on this were kind of crystallized by an article in The Undefeated by Soraya Nadia McDonald. And she has two, it's about Antebellum and Lovecraft Country. You can, you know, just Google The Undefeated Lovecraft Country, you'll get to it. It's worth a read, I think. She said kind of two things that really crystallized my thinking here, which was, or maybe not crystallized, but I was like, yes, that's what I'm thinking. I'm going to quote from them a little bit. Lovecraft Country is filled with gags that don't go anywhere. The show is sprinkled with details that identify its writers as learned. When Tick walks into a segregated library to do research, Cameron lingers on a portrait of W.B. Du Bois. When the family drives across the country, the soundtrack of their odyssey is James Baldwin's debate with William F. Buckley. But these various details don't point to much besides the obvious fact that racism is omnipresent in America and really scary. And then it just kind of is piling stuff up and it doesn't really go anywhere. And I think it wants you to feel like you're smart for, oh, that's James Baldwin. I know that. Oop, I know who, you know, I know what this reference is. I know what this rep, but it, they don't ultimately mean anything or go anywhere. And the other thing, I'm really glad she wrote in this article because the episode that focused on Ruby, I was feeling this weirdness about basically the manager of the store. Like, I'm like, oh, okay, he's a totally obvious villain. And she, Soraya McDonald, writes, the big bads in Antebellum, which I haven't seen, but she's writing about, and Lovecraft Country, on the other hand, are filmic paper tigers. Standard issue white people who feel one note to engender any emotional investment in their demise. They aren't so much characters as a collection of tropes. Their racism seems as much a casual choice as their taste for cheap dye jobs. And I thought, that is a really interesting point. Because it makes the whole experience and investment of the show feel thinner. Why are these people racist? They're racist because they're racist. Why are these people bad? They're bad because they're bad. No more thought than that. And I really like the way she said it. It feels like instead of something baked into or ingrained into people, like, and why are they racist? I just am. Kind of like how I like ties. It's a good article. I would really recommend folks reading it. And especially as the storytelling seems to be falling apart, it is increasingly annoying to me that the show, I think, wants you to feel like you're making a progressive move by watching. And I find that deeply irritating.
I'm curious if the book is laid out like the show is.
I don't believe it is. Based on book reviews, no more than that.
And I'll say that the show has never matched the intensity of the slow motion car chase from episode one. That seemed to be its
peak. I think I agree with that. Although I think overall my favorite episode might be the haunted house one, because there was a lot of stuff. And that was another, that was a case where references to things in there, like the exploitative loans that banks would give black mm-hmm. people, felt necessary. And I went and looked things up and learned something, and it felt like it pointed somewhere.
That's good. So Lovecraft Country, does it have one more episode or two?
Got a couple more.
Okay. Well, we'll see. But as for us, that is it for this week. We'll be back next Tuesday. In the meantime, subscribe to us, rate us on your podcast app, and tell a friend that we exist. We will definitely talk at least a little bit of Fargo next week, so everyone bug Adam into watching it. And we'll talk to everyone then. Thanks.